Blog Talk Radio.
Father's Day to all the fathers that are listening, and welcome to The Man's Voice. Today's show is going to be a little interesting in that most of the men who are fathers that are on the panel are off sharing their days with their families, which is a well-deserved break from the show, but we have a few who are still on, and we're going to scale it down a little bit. We're just going to have casual conversation today, nothing too intense at the moment. I want to welcome the panel, and first of all, let me say to all the listeners who are listening, happy Father's Day. Thank you for joining us in, and you can always join the conversation by, if you hear something you want to talk about, call us at 646-668-8740. I want to say hello to panelists. I think today we have, a couple of people. We have somebody from Virginia, somebody from Miami, somebody from Atlanta, and we're just going to have general conversations, and I really wanted to start it off with, and it'll be me and the panelists, so they know, can jump in anytime, any conversation, any good thing you want to talk about today. It's a very casual show, so those of you that are listening, lay back and enjoy it as we spin this for you. I just wanted to start off with fathers. I wanted to talk about fathers, and I want to throw this out there about fathers. It has always puzzled me that fathers throughout the generations since the beginning of the Bible have been kind of in the background, because I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, there has been some hypothesis on it, but whatever happened to Joseph, the father of Jesus? We know that according to the Neil Opstad version of the Bible, that Mary ascended into heaven, but we don't really know what happened to Joseph. I mean, there's no really account in the Bible what happened to him. So as a father, he's kind of in the background, but he was a major part in the life of Jesus Christ, but we really don't know what happened to him. And it seems to have been the tradition since that time. So I want to talk about that. That's just to me, and that might be a strange way of looking at it, but I want to start out with that, and then I want to talk about how valuable fathers are, you know, to the life, two families, you know, without, you know, the strong will of the patriarch of the family, a lot of families, you know, would be in dismiss. What do you think about that, Ron? And I don't want to start calling on you guys. Just jump in. Go ahead, Ron. You start it off.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting topic that you bring up, because I think, having a father figure when you're growing up, I think, is important, although we all know that I think increasingly there's less of a father figure presence in a lot of families. And I may get myself in trouble for saying this, but I think maybe especially in the minority communities, there's less of a father figure present. And again, you know, I don't have any solid figures to back that up, but, you know, it's just the what I see in the news, and that's the impression that I get from what I've seen and read. But again, you know, I think, I mean, I grew up, well, actually, my case is kind of interesting. I did have a father, you know, throughout my entire childhood, but actually he was a Greyhound bus driver, so he was gone most of the time. So, you know, I was pretty much raised primarily by my mom, even though, you know, there was a father. You know, I think I turned out to be an okay human being, an okay citizen, as well as my brothers. But, you know, I still think there's a lot of value added to a family when there's a father figure present. That's just the way I feel. You know, I think, And of course, you know, there's, you know, same sex families now, you know, families where you have two fathers or two mothers, single parent families where you have just one father or just the mother raising the kid. You know, there's all kinds of variations. And, you know, I'm not saying that they don't do a good job. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of them, or maybe most of them, do a good job raising the kids. But, you know, I think it's good for a kid growing up to have both a mother and a father present.
You know, I really take objection, and I want to talk about this later. I really want to say on the positive of fathers. But the fact that you said that most minorities, that it's in your mind that minorities have a problem with fathers. And I grew up as a minority in a neighborhood, and I didn't, the families that are where I grew up, there weren't fathers missing. And we thought it was quite the opposite, that, you know, that the majority population didn't have a lot of fathers, whereas in my neighborhood, all the fathers were there. As a matter of fact, I lived in where the village raised a child, and people down the street could give you a spanking if you were acting up. So I think that you have been obsessed by the media, and I think the media has a big piece of way you're seeing that it is not necessarily true nationally. Shane, what do you think about fathers? And let's talk about something nice about fathers for a change. Shane, why don't you go ahead?
Well, growing up, my dad worked in trade shows. He traveled a lot for work, so he wasn't always there, but it was always nice because I did have a father figure present through my entire childhood and upbringing. And when he was home, you know, it was nice to have that balance. I was primarily raised by my mom, but, you know, when my dad was around, we would go to baseball games and sporting events. I remember when the Thrashers were still in Atlanta, we would go to hockey games all the time. And it was just a great bonding experience. He was also really active when I was growing up in sports. He was always given feedback. I played football and baseball a lot. And when the coaches weren't always paying, like, direct one-on-one attention to me, it was always nice to have my dad there to be like, hey, in that last play, you know, I saw this. You know, maybe you try this instead. You might be a little more successful. It was nice to have that feedback. And just kind of that discipline growing up as well, where I feel sometimes in, well, single parent households or whatever the case may be, occasionally that discipline is lacking, or you don't have that male role model to look up to. And I think it is super, super important to have in a family dynamic, just for young boys to have that example to look up to, that model to strive to be, I guess, especially if the father is a positive influence on the family.
All right. What I want to ask about that question, because this morning I was going through the news media, and there was a tennis player, one of the top 100 tennis players, who is raising children as a dad who is now married to another male, and one of the female, it was a big thing going on right now in tennis, because this female came out from Australia saying that children need moms and dads, not dads. So it's a big controversy within, and they changed the name of the Australian gym because she said that. The question is, do you believe dads can raise kids as well as moms? What do you think, Frank?
Yeah, actually, I do. It's not unheard of to have, you know, two dads in a family like that, where, or even single dads raising children. I think a lot of people look at the maternal role as mostly caregiver and emotional support, and that fathers are usually breadwinners and therefore discipline and usually given the role of the bad guy most of the time. But honestly, I feel that men have and fathers have the same capacity for compassion and emotional support as mothers a lot of the time. It really just depends on the environment in which you're raised and the support of both or one parent in any given situation.
Right. Frank, are you there? All right. Frank.
I am.
Oh, okay. Yes. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that two parents are most important. You know, I got raised with two parents in the household, stepfather and a mother. And I think that connections to the grandparents are extremely important as well. So that's my take on it. I don't think, you know, I can say that the kids that I observed that have single parents and they're female. I haven't observed as many male single parents, except for I can say that I've observed you before, and you do a great job. But some of the women that I observe, the kids, the boys, seem to be set up as girls. In other words, their feminine characteristics, the hair, you know, their hair conditioning or combing ends up being in a more girlish style than a male style. That bothers me a lot because in one case I had a relative where I did not know for a couple hours that the kid that I was looking at was actually a boy. I thought the young person was a girl, and I was very confused. The only way that came out of that is they were going to the boys' bathroom. And I said, "Oh, I missed that." So, I've seen that a lot, you know, earrings, so you obviously know I'm not pro earrings in your ears for guys. So that's my contribution. I think, fathers are important. I want to congratulate all of you who stand in as fathers, real fathers, stepfathers, and people who just take care of young people in a fatherly manner.
You know, one thing that I've noticed, and I've said this before on the show, I see more young men out walking their kids and pushing carts and walking kids to school than ever before. I don't know what that is saying, but I haven't seen as many young men out with children, babies, and toddlers in the numbers that I've seen recently. I think it's a good thing. I'm glad to see it, but it just seems that young men are becoming more back in as family patriarchs. Do you have any comments on that, Ron? And I don't want to keep asking. Just jump in and talk. Let's just have a casual conversation, Ron. But Ron, what do you think about that?
You know, I really haven't observed either way. You know, whether it's whether they're doing it more often or less often. I mean, I do see a lot of fathers pushing around strollers, especially where I live. You know, maybe it's got something to do with the different communities. I don't know. But I don't seem to see a decline in that. I mean, you know, I know that, you know, mothers more and more, I guess, are out there in the workforce, and you know, and at least from what I see, I mean, I don't see as much of, you know, like when I was growing up, you know, my mom was a stay at home mom, and most of my friends, their moms were stay at home moms. I don't really see, you know, stay at home moms that much anymore.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking about something Frank said about women raising boys. The boys look like girls, I guess, at a certain age in their lungs. So I was thinking the converse of that. Do you think, Frank, men raising daughters make the daughters more masculine?
You know, I don't want to be prejudicial on that, but I wouldn't think so, because I don't have a tendency to try to turn a girl into a boy. You know, I've had a daughter who told me that she was a tomboy later years when she got to be an adult. But, you know, we try to comb their hair, braid their hair, and take them to places that, you know, where feminine people hang out so they can be in agreement with their species, you know, their sex. So but you know, to my disappointment, I see quite often a lot of kids with big diamond earrings in their ears, and they're guys, okay, and they're 8 years old or 9 years old or 7 years old, and that's problematic, I think, for knowing who you are. And I know athletes do it, and I know there's very popular athletes. Michael Jordan does it and everything else. I think it's one thing when you're 18 years old and you do it. I think it's another thing when you're 7 years old. So I don't know. I don't think that men try to make young ladies into men if they were raising them in a single condition, as a single parent.
But I don't think, you know, I don't think, you know, I'm not disagreeing entirely, Frank, but I don't think that if it's a woman, you know, raising a young boy and, you know, they're looking girlish and, you know, with the earrings and the hair and, you know, like you were describing, I don't think that means that the boy is going to end up being gay, you know, because, you're born or you're not born, you know, straight or gay. And so, you know, they may be, I mean, I have a lot of friends that are actually straight, but they act feminine, you know, and when you first see them, you say, oh, he's definitely gay, but they're not, they love women and they're straight. But maybe they were raised by, you know, by their moms, like you were saying.
Yeah, no, and I wasn't, yeah, and I didn't, and that's not the reason why, I really indicated that whether they were, you know, children that were gay or become gay. I didn't think that the issue to me is that, the issue to me is from old school, men don't wear earrings. Men don't wear heavy amounts of jewelry. There's it's just a masculine female thing. I think that we have both sides as males. We have female side as well as our male side. And it may be, you know, like I said, it may turn out to make a peaceful individual when they get to be adult because they wore that type of jewelry, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work, for instance, in the armed forces of the United States, having, you know, jewelry, that type of jewelry in your ear. And, so I just think that, and it doesn't, you know, when you see young children that are, their hair is braided and you can't tell whether they're a male or female, that's, and they don't have but one parent, then that's kind of bothersome to me, but what's going on in what direction. And I'm not saying they're trying to send them in a homosexual direction, because I think they can grow up and be like that and be a male. But I'm not sure that they're taking on the work ethic and all the other things that males are supposed to do that we're talking about on Father's Day, okay? Head of the household, the lead person in the workforce, that type of thing. And I know in some cases the women are the lead persons in the workforces, but we still want to have a heavy influence of males being in those positions because that's what males should do, in my estimation. That kind of clarify what I was really thinking on this? It's those male things, whether they, no matter what their sexual preference would be to another person, will they be a stand-up person, a stand-up guy? Okay, will they sacrifice for their family? Okay, or will they just whine?
Yeah, I wonder if there's any statistics about that.
I don't know. I'm just telling you. Yeah, that's just what I've observed when I go into what I call the civilian community of relatives and everything else. And I'm not talking about a guy that's 18 or 19 that makes a preference, whatever his life preference is of appearance. I'm talking about those kids that are still seven. Do they really know if they're male or female? Is it important that they know that they're male or female?
An interesting question.
Yeah. To keep it on a light note, I want to ask a question. And once again, I'm not leaving this, guys. So anyway, it seems that way. I just wanted, what is your most fond experience with your dad? Shane, what is your most fond experience of your dad or with your dad?
My most fond experience with my dad? I'd say probably growing up and going through sports and having that kind of male influence. Like I said, he was kind of like a second coach when I needed some one-on-one feedback, or just even going to sporting events, just having a good time and just getting a chance to bond with my father and just kind of, you know, see things from his perspective, get that positive male influence. And I feel like I turned out okay, even though he wasn't there all the time. But, you know, it's just having him around personally, just like whenever I needed something, whenever I needed a male perspective on things, he was always there for me. And so I guess there are a lot of really fond experiences I had with him.
What about you, Frank?
Well, I think the biggest experience I had as a stepfather, you know, stepfather's life is very tough because kids don't necessarily, and I was one of them, don't embrace the stepfather. Taking me to places like Disneyland and was important, and being there to tell me a little bit about life was extremely important also. I did spend time with my grandparents a lot as one of the unique members of my family. And so I would go to work in the summertime with my grandfather. He owned the business. And that is very important to me even to this day, what I learned from that and the relationship of how to work. And I had a strong influence also with my grandmother. I was her traveling companion, so I just want to set that straight if you think I'm, you know, anti-female. I'm not. And that was a very strong relationship as well, okay? So I think that what parents do and what I try to do as a parent is be an example, be a good example of what that father figure should be doing and how they should respond to situations that require male leadership in the family. And that male leadership could be with a strong female leadership, but the way it's set up or was set up in the past is it was generally the male figures who were supposed to do that. So I think that being a father is important to teach your kids how to be in the world and what's going to happen down the road.
Right. Ron, what about you?
Well, my fondest memory, without a doubt, is, you know, my father having been a Greyhound bus driver every summer. He used to take one of the elite and upscale private schools down here on a month-long road trip across the United States. And, you know, as young as 8, 9, 10 years old, I used to go with him. And, you know, my mom didn't go. My brothers didn't go. It was just my dad and me for the entire month. And, you know, I think that has made me the person I am today. I mean, I love to travel, but I think, you know, bonding with him during those trips really helped me. And, you know, I didn't have my grandparents. I didn't have my grandfathers, I should say, present, because on my dad's side, you know, they lived in Kentucky, so they weren't down here. And on my mom's side, my grandfather on my mom's side died in Cuba, so I never even got to meet him. So really, it was just my dad. And, you know, when I was home in Miami, he would be out on the road a lot. But, you know, spending those summers with him was something that I'll never forget.
All right. Frank, why don't you lead the next conversation?
Well, I want to start off by saying it's wonderful to be a grandparent. I'll tell you that part. For those of you who are not familiar with that responsibility, it's probably, I would describe, as a heavenly walk. So for me, it is more than life to be a grandparent. And and we talked about being an example and helping out. So I get a chance as a grandparent of two children that are 3 and 2 years old, moving towards the 4 and 3-year-old category to be with them like 3 to 4 days a week, you know, let's say 10 hours, and to help and see them in their development. And that's really a wonderful thing, just to watch a child's vocabulary expand and seek you for help and guidance. It includes, you know, changing underwear, feeding, and protecting. So, but there is no job like it. And maybe I missed it when I was a father, because I enjoyed being a father of small children as well as older children. But being a grandfather and doing it, it just fills me up.
Okay. Ron, next conversation.
Something happened to me last night that, you know, really made me feel good about humans. And, you know, I don't always, as you know, David, always have, you know, the highest respect for the way humans behave, especially when it comes toward other animals. And, you know, there's a saying that you can tell how great a civilization is by the way it treats its animals. And, you know, we all know that there's a lot of animal abuse going on out there. But last night I went to buy cat food for my cat, and I ran in the parking lot into these two old ladies, and they had two cartfuls, I mean, full to the brim of cat food, dry food, canned food, wet food, cat litter. And I said, wow, you know, I just struck up a conversation with them. I said, wow, you must have a lot of cats. And one of them, it turns out, had, I think it was like 50 something cats, not all indoors, but, you know, cats that she takes care of. And the other one had like 70 something cats. And then, you know, we ended up talking for, I would say, a good half an hour. And it turns out that they, you know, go around the neighborhood and feed the homeless cats. And they do this, you know, they're both retired, so they don't have a lot of money. They actually look like they're dirt poor. And to make matters even worse, I think it was the night before, or maybe a couple of nights, mornings before, one of them went to McDonald's in a suburb here in Miami, which is actually not a bad area, and she was assaulted. Her car was stolen. All her money was stolen. All her IDs were stolen, and, of course, all the cat food was stolen. So, and this lady also has COPD, but yet she finds it with, you know, and the way she explained it to me was so beautiful. She finds that, you know, helping, I think she said, about 200 cats every night in different areas of Miami. She goes and she feeds them, whether it's raining or not, or, you know, whatever conditions. And she goes out there and she, you know, with her little money that she has, she goes out there and she takes care of these animals because she knows that nobody else does. And, you know, that was pretty heartwarming to me. And I know that there's people out there that, and maybe some of our panelists are thinking this, that these ladies are probably wacko. Because, you know, there are a lot of people out there that feel, you know, that there might be some hoarding going on. But I didn't see it that way. And because they're not in their house, you know, they just go around the community and help the animals. And, you know, I said, wow, how nice was that? You know, if more people would do that and care, you know, maybe this would be a better place.
Respecting your comments on that, you know what, that's kind of a bothersome thing to me, because I've been on military installations where we have stray cats who have, you know, historically been there several generations, and we're always told not to feed them because they don't go anywhere when you feed them. They stay there. So I don't know. And the people that I've seen with multiple number of cats, and you said they weren't in their houses, but the ones that I've seen in their houses have some mental issues. typically when they have that sizable number of cats, like over three or four.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. I feel the same way. But as far as feeding them, I work for the Humane Society here in Miami, and there's actually programs that help people that are helping the community cats, and I mean, we go out in the community and we trap the cats, we neuter them, and then we release them back into where they came from. I don't think cats, just because you're not feeding them, are going to go away. You know, they'll
right,
figure out a
right.
way to survive. You know, but if they're not eating properly, they might start. Actually, they might start killing birds, which is not a good thing either. Especially if they're native birds. It can get into a whole lot of different scenarios, I see your point, and I do agree that people that have a lot of cats or dogs or a lot of anything at home, they probably have some issues going on. I'm totally in accordance with that.
All right. Shane, do you have do you want to start the next conversation?
Yes.
I'm going to say Shane sounds awful quiet like he was, but our first conversation, it was deep and very, very, concentrated on different subjects and topics. So he does have a lot to talk about. He's just being awful quiet these last couple of weeks. But go ahead, Shane. Let's hear what you want to talk about.
I've just been sitting back and enjoying the conversation. Honestly, the last one made me think about one of my aunts in New Jersey. She's very, very big on, taking care of animals, and there are a few feral cats outside of where she lives, and she'll put out food for them, and she's not to the level of, like, taking them in and housing them per se, but she does reach out and help there, and I think it's super cool to see people even just for animals look out for those less fortunate. I think if more people did go out of their way to try to help in that kind of situation, there would be less of a problem. Also, if people got their animals spayed and neutered, if they are indoor, outdoor, it does severely reduce the population of feral cats roaming areas, stuff like that. But honestly, I've just kind of been sitting back and listening, thinking about different stuff to myself. A lot of what you guys said is just kind of made me think about my own family and people that I know and that kind of thing. But I just along the lines of taking care of people, I don't know how you guys feel about the homeless. Obviously, it's an issue. But I've known people that when that I do get asked for spare change or a couple dollars here and there, I'll give, just because my mom raised me in an environment where, her thought was, it doesn't matter what these people do with the money. What matters is that you gave out of the kindness of your heart, right? But I've been given a lot of mess, to put it that way. When I do these kinds of things to try to look out for people who can't necessarily look out for themselves, or whether they want to or not is not my decision to say, just kind of, I don't know. I guess I just kind of would like to hear you guys' opinions on that kind of thing.
Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about some good practices that I thought about the homeless. In our area, there's a couple things that happen. One is during the colder months, a number of congregation of churches house them overnight, generally for a week's period of time, and feed them high-end cuisine during that period of time as well. Typically make their lunch forms, because a lot of the people that are homeless are really working poor as well, who actually go to work, but for whatever reason, and it could be issues with their family internal, they're not able to stay in the same household as their family. So normally what these best practices that I've observed is they get them bus tickets so they can go to work during that week period and pack their lunch for them in the morning, feed them breakfast, and feed them a meal, and provide shower and haircut and some clothing as well during the colder months. And in the summer months and everything, they have these soup kitchens. In fact, our church was soliciting the day for some products it needed to do its part to go down to the local shelter. What they do is prepare a meal at the shelter and serve it. We also have the last thing is that's really, really a wonderful thing, I think, is the cities have started building housing that they can house the homeless. So, and counseling centers. We've got a center now where the city's bought this valuable piece of property, land, cleared it off. It's going to put everybody there, every type of counseling agency, drug, alcohol, city, as well as church-related counselors. And in addition, they've already started and housed people in buildings that they've built, new buildings that have been set up just for the homeless. And basically, in some cases, I think you stay there for 6 months. It's furnished. In some cases, you stay for a lesser period of time. And they've done this on a joint basis as well, which is hard around here because we've got 7 or 8 cities that are all independent. But they'll generally build it on a common land that's co-located between the two cities close to the borderline of the city. And the housing is very nice housing. So there's an effort underway in our area to take care of the homeless. Although, you know, sometimes they take care of the homeless, the motivation is to move them from a more expensive area to an area that's not so expensive because they're going to put a coliseum in or something like that. So that's my observation. And again, I agree that when you provide funding, at least my opinion is as well, is if you provide funding, it's you've done your part, and what they do, it is up to them.
Right. I like the homeless people with the signs that actually tell the truth. I need money for a beer or something, have you seen? But, Ron, in Miami, they charge in South Beach a homeless tax that you see on your receipt. You pay 0.1% or something homeless tax. And I know that in Miami, they were getting in Florida, in Miami, they were getting it, or South Beach, they were getting in trouble because they would take that money, buy a van, load up all the homeless people, take them in the next city and drop them off. And the next cities were then starting to, Miami, Miami Beach were sending all their homeless up to their cities. But I do know that when you go in Miami Beach, that you're going to pay tax. Is that still the way it is down there, Ron?
Well, you've said that before, and I don't. I'm not aware of a homeless tax, but I can tell you for sure that every time that I do go to South Beach, there are a lot of homeless people. You know, our weather down here is nice, so you know it lends itself to, you know, living out on the streets more readily than, you know, places up north where it's frigid. Or so there are a lot of homeless people. There are in Miami Beach, there are a lot of homeless people in Miami. You know, they do have resources. There's a place called Camilla's House, you know, which provides you know, lodging and, you know, a place to sleep, a place to eat, a place to shower. But you know, I think those are like temporary fixes. But one thing that hasn't come up during the conversation so far is I think, because I remember there was a homeless old lady that I used to see every day when I used to walk to work when I was working downtown. And the city came by and picked her up. And sure enough, I don't know if it was the next day, but for sure a few days later, she was back out there again homeless. So I think a lot of the homeless people maybe have some mental problems going on. Which means that, in my opinion, that they need more than just, you know, a warm bed and a warm meal, you know, and I think also a lot of them don't want to be helped, you know, and maybe that's just, you know, because I've heard that, so I don't know that for a fact, but I've heard that a lot of homeless people, you offer help and they don't want, you know, they would rather stay homeless. And I can't comprehend that, like the comfort of my home, but I don't know what's going on through their minds, you know? So, people are always in different places and different situations in life. And, you know, I never ostracize or make fun of anybody that's homeless, because, you know, and anybody can be a step or two away from being homeless very easily. I mean, you could have a medical catastrophe, and, you know, there goes all your savings, and you may even lose your house. I mean, you never know. You never know what's going to happen. So, but back to your original question, yes, there are a lot of homeless people in Miami Beach. So I don't think that they're shipping them away to other cities, like you say.
Well, they used to. I know. I know, because the other cities were complaining. There was a big news article down there at one time about the cities, Fort Lauderdale and above, complaining that Miami Beach was dropping off all their homeless in the middle of the night after they round them up.
They must have stopped, because there's definitely a lot of homeless in Miami Beach now.
Speaking of homeless, you know, one of the ladies that works with Do Good Causes for years, one lady posted about the number of homeless in San Francisco. She was visiting San Francisco, and there's an extraordinary amount of homeless in San Francisco. And the other lady posted, who works with her, said, well, you know, the homeless should think about moving to a less expensive place. And, you know, I thought it was ridiculous, but that's how sometimes we think about homeless people. But I do agree that they have a lot of people in the homeless community have mental issues, and that's why the city of Virginia Beach is putting together a comprehensive center. So that's going to cover, you know, 15, 20 different types of issues that impact a person, and why they won't or cannot stay in a regular home. Sometimes they're ordered by the courts not to be present in their home. And then you've got veterans, you've got drug issues, that also alcohol issues. So I think that the homes, us dealing with the homeless population in the United States is very important, and to all of us, because those are our brothers and sisters out there. And you're right, I could be there just as easy as they are, given the right combination of things.
Right, and I completely agree. And I think it is awesome that they're opening a place for these people to get the counseling and the help they need, because from what I've read, a lot of them do suffer from mental disabilities or past trauma. You have former veterans with PTSD that just can't stay in their homes because of the multiple triggers and whatever the case may be. And I think that it is great that there is a place in Virginia Beach where they can go to get the help they need and the counseling that they deserve to try to live a functional kind of life. And maybe other cities across the United States could take a page from their playbook and try to open centers to try to help cut down on homelessness and the root causes of it.
You know, there was a big veteran
homeless
population, but I was reading recently where the VA is touting that their homeless in the military veterans is down by 70%. And so I don't know which program or how they're doing that. I think I see on some of the bases now where they have facilities that are not being used, so they turn them into homeless facilities for veterans. But I think if there's a model in America that we should look at and emulate if possible, we should look at the way the federal government is handling the homeless veteran problem. Because I think that with the press that I've seen recently, they got a good program going on.
Yeah, what they're doing, David, because I was in real estate, they actually have counselors now assigned to, I don't know if they handle more than one veteran, but they actually track the veterans. Walk out there with the veteran to help them secure a rental place, and that's how I've encountered them. They And so what they'll do is a veteran, they'll find a person homeless. They give them a subsidy also. There's some funds. I don't know how long the funds run for, but, you know, the problems with renting a prop when you're homeless is having a deposit and having someone stand with you. So they'll come out when they're showing the property. That may include giving them a ride. They'll follow up with me about how they're doing. And if they need to help them with their rent, they'll secure funds for them. And some of those funds are from the government, some of them are from the local city.
Right. Okay. I wanted to go back to, we were talking about animals, and I want to talk and turn this out and see where this goes. But I'm anti-neutering animals. I don't understand why, but I don't think they, because the shelters run, when the animals go in, they neuter them. Why is it they don't wait until maybe someone decides to purchase that animal out of the shelter if they should be neutered? I know why they do it, but is there that you're neutering everything that comes in without thinking of anything else? Anything that comes in the national shelters is automatically spayed. I'm kind of against that. Where are you on this in the industry? But I know you know that I know why it's done, because of, but isn't that just over the top? For me, it is.
I don't think you really understand why it's being done. And by the way, you were breaking in and out, so I could hear only about half of what you were saying. So I'm not even sure you were talking to me, but I'm assuming you were.
Yes.
But the primary reason, well, there's two primary reasons that it's done. One is for the health of the animal. You know, there's studies after studies that show that, especially like males that are sterilized have less of a chance of developing cancer and other life-threatening diseases, and females too. So, you know, that's one reason. And the other reason too is there's a serious, serious pet overpopulation problem in the United States. You know, we think that this is a third world country problem, but in Miami-Dade County alone, there's 2.7 million residents, and there's 400,000, so, you know, chalk it up to 500,000 homeless, what we call community cats. You know, dogs is not, you know, obviously dogs is not as big of a problem as cats, but when you have 500,000 cats out there that aren't fixed, you know, and I don't remember the exact statistics, but that has a multiplier effect that is astronomical. And, you know, if you don't take care of them, you know, when you first have an opportunity to do so, the problem is going to continue to get more and more out of hand, which means in the long run that the animals are going to have to be euthanized for no good reason, because there's simply not enough people out there to adopt these animals. So those are the two main reasons that they're fixed.
Shane, where are you?
David, have you ever?
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
David, have you ever seen 40 or 50 cats at one house?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. It's a sight. And what happens is some of the cats, because they're feral, I guess, they are vicious or appear to be vicious, and they scare inhabitants, or they do things that will have a tendency to be violent or appear to be violent. So that's one of the problems when you don't. When people, you know, the same thing happens in Alaska, by the way. When I was a child, people go down south and leave their dogs to survive on their own, and they join in the packs, and then sometimes bite or eat smaller people like children and other animals. And so they'd be running wolf packs. And so when I was in New York City as an officer there, I used to be in a meat market district, and I'd be frightened every morning because I had to walk by the scraps the meat market people would put out. And there'd be packs of dogs that would come in, you know, 14, 15 dogs. And I guess fortunately those dogs didn't bother me. They went right for the scraps, and they'd walk, brush into my leg, you know, kind of bumping my leg. But, you know, when you see that many animals that are in a pack and you're just trying to go to work and you have to go through that every day, it's quite mentally stressful.
All right. I think I do understand all the reasons, but I don't understand why, if they have animals to be adopted out and the person comes to adopt it, that person doesn't have the, because I might want to breed these dogs and, to, you know, it's already been spayed or neutered when I come to get it from the animal shelter. I just don't, you know, they're taking them in. They're not letting them out back in the wild. Why are they spaying and neutering them? Because they think it's going to, it might get away. So 1 out of 100, maybe. I understand the ones that are out wild running around, you know, when, but once you collect them and you're charging a fee to come get it, but you've already spayed or neutered it, that person doesn't have, you know, the right to mate it or anything. So it's just kind of questionable to me. And I'm sure everybody has their thing. What do you think about neutering, Shane?
I think it is beneficial for the most part. I think for people that do want to breed dogs, there are places where you can get animals that have paperwork and all these other, like, vaccinations and all the other good stuff. But they are, they'll have all their parts intact for breeding.
Those dogs cost $1,500, $2,000.
Right, right. And they are very, very expensive. But they're also being used to, for the most part, turn a profit. It's, if you think about it as an investment, you put down maybe $1,500 to $2,000 and you've got a dog with good genetics, then you still have an opportunity to turn around and make that kind of money off of every puppy. And when dogs are giving birth to litters of 5 to 6 to 7 puppies at a time, in some cases, there is a lot of potential for monetary growth there. But when it comes to shelter animals, most of these are just being adopted as pets. And spaying and neutering is, it's a substantial fee a lot of the time, that sometimes these families don't have the extra means. When getting a dog, they don't necessarily think about, oh yeah, I've got to go take them to the vet and get all their shots and get them spayed or neutered. And that is, it's a substantial amount of money to get all that stuff done. So I personally think that it is beneficial for shelters to take care of that problem when they do take in animals, especially for those that are going to be adopted as indoor-outdoor animals, especially cats, and because they do have the tendency to populate so frequently. And with litters of, again, like 5 or 6 at a time, the community cat problem does become an issue and it multiplies. So personally, I'm on board with the spaying and neutering of animals, just to help keep feral populations down and I honestly look out for the health and well-being of the animals.
And David, the fact of the matter is that most of the dogs and cats or dogs that are in shelters are not pure breed. I would say at least 90%, if not more, are not pure breed. So, you know, why would you want to mate an animal? I mean, most of the people that are out there looking to breed animals want to breed purebred animals for a profit, like Shane was saying. So I just don't see where you're going with this.
All right. Well, okay. But we only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to tie it up back to Father's Day. And I want to just talk a little bit simply in the last 5 minutes about one of the hardest jobs of any father, and I think that's stepfather. And I think stepfather who gets into a family of younger kids has a easier time at adjustment than a stepfather who gets into 9, 10, or 11-year-old kids and the sons and daughters who have to accept him. And so I want to express my appreciation to all the stepfathers out there who are having Father's Day today, but I also want to just throw it out. To me, that's one of the hardest fathering jobs there is. What do you think, Shane?
Yeah, I'd agree with you, especially when they do come into families of older children that have had a really close relationship to their father and have lost him for any number of reasons, especially when you look at teenagers going through puberty and trying to get to know themselves as people. To lose a father and then have that adjustment where this man comes into your life through, you know, your mother or whatever. I think that adjustment is difficult, to say the least, for both parties involved. For the stepfather, not only to try to relate to kids that he hasn't been around for, say, 15, 16 years of their lives, and to try to take that role model role, that masculine role to look up to, it's absolutely got to be difficult. And I can't even imagine what it must be like for some of these stepfathers and some of these kids. I was personally fortunate enough to still have both my parents and them still be together. But I absolutely appreciate all the stepfathers out there who do make that effort to kind of just step up and fill that role or maybe that void in a family dynamic.
Right. And last thing, I'm going to give a plug for fathers because I was listening to a radio show, and it was a call-in radio show to ask, what are you purchasing for your husband, your father, your son, and what, and they were trying to figure out what is the best gift. And what I heard was a bunch of women calling in saying, buy them tools or buy them something to work with, buy them something to fix on the house with. But as I grew up, my mother always said, do not give me anything to work in the kitchen. I don't want any pots or pans or anything like that. I don't want a vacuum cleaner. I want something personal. And I think as we've gone through time, and, you know, there was and I was surprised, the classic thing is give him a tie, give him some tools, you know, and to me, I want a Rolex. I can use diamonds and gold. You don't have to give me tools and everything. What do you think, Ron?
Yeah, I think ties, and I'm not a father myself, but I think if I were and I would get a tie or a tool or something like that, I would be disappointed. I mean, I don't think a lot of thought goes into those particular gifts. I mean, I'm more of a sentimental person, so I would rather receive something that has meaning, you know, and, you know, for example, my brother, who's not even, you know, has nothing to do with Father's Day with me, but, you know, he puts a lot of thought into his gifts. And, you know, like one year he gave me a family, you know, it was a framed family tree with actual photos of, you know, going back as far as he could into the 1700s. And, you know, that meant a lot. I mean, he put some effort into that. And everybody, if they really wanted to, can put some effort into really making a nice, meaningful gift for somebody. A tie to me or a tool just doesn't cut it. You know, maybe I'm being too shallow or superficial about this, but, you know, I don't think that's a well thought out gift.
What about you, Frank? We got about 90 seconds. What do you think?
Sure. Stepfathers take a real beating. Okay. They're not underappreciated. They're the real heroes in our life. For me, I don't care what the gift is. If a child gives it to me, any gift they give me, however small, is wonderful.
Right.
And I'm just appreciative that they have a relationship.
Right. I even, you know, a small difference is a child, I'm talking about your rifle, because a child, even the drawing they did at school, you know, you appreciate those are gifts that will last forever.
Yes.
But you got about 30 seconds, Shane. What do you think?
I think it really depends on the father. I agree that a lot of the time, if it's just to get tools because you think your dad should be taking care of the house, it is a little not as thought out as maybe a personal drawing or a card with a sentimental a note. Or, you know, my dad loves to read, so maybe getting him one of the next books in one of his series would be, even just that would be a little bit more sentimental, a little bit more meaningful than just getting him a tool or a tie, you know?
All right. Got about 10 seconds left. I want to thank everybody who
Happy Father's Day.
Yeah,
Happy Father's Day.
You know, and rest of your day. Your sun is finally coming out here in Atlanta. I hope where you are, you're enjoying it, barbecuing, having fun. Kiss your kids, kiss your wife. Have a good evening. And thanks, panel. We'll see you again next week, 6 o'clock, for The Man's Voice.